what happens when all of the things we've talked about so far just don't work? What if there's still someone you can't get through to? Well, then it's time for what is really the shape up or ship out discussion, the last conversation that you have with an employee. Sometimes called power counseling, this technique differs markedly from normal performance counseling, which is more conversational and relaxed. This isn't the usual conversation where you simply say, "I want to draw this deficiency or problem to your attention, and I want you to take care of it." This is not the simple little warning, "I want you to knock this off." This is the last real effort that you're going to make to reach this person. Having such a conversation is not always appropriate. In a case where you've gotten so disgusted with a person that you want to terminate them, then I suggest you proceed with termination. This conversation, you see, is appropriate only if you buy the premises on which it's based. If you accept the assumptions that are the foundation for this performance counseling system, then you may have some success. But if you don't buy the premises, then simply going through the motions of the technique won't help. This is a very powerful counseling approach. Variations of this approach have been used with alcoholics when nothing else has worked, and with delinquent teenagers when parents are at the end of their rope. It's a technique known as tough love. Let me here acknowledge that credit for applying this technique to work settings is based on the outstanding contribution of Dr. Mark Silber. Much of what I'll be talking about here is based on Dr. Silber's experience as a practicing organizational and industrial psychologist. This is a very powerful approach. It is, in layman's terms, what might be referred to as psychosurgery. It's an advanced technique. And because of its power and the conditions that have to exist for it to be effective, it becomes absolutely essential that you accept its underlying premises. Let's review what those premises are. And if you can support those, we'll then proceed to a review of the specific steps. Let's discuss five power counseling premises. First, as a supervisor, you have an obligation to act. I believe that people don't simply respond to commands. Sometimes people need assistance and guidance and active intervention more than they need orders. This is something that personnel can't do, something that no one else in the organization but the supervisor can do. And if the supervisor thinks there's a ghost of a chance of salvaging this person, if the supervisor has the willingness and the energy to try and rescue this person, then it is his or her responsibility, his or her privilege and obligation to take action. A second premise for power counseling is that both people in the equation, the employee and the supervisor, need to recognize the problem for what it is and for what it is not. Problem employees are not problems in every aspect of their behavior. They are probably on target or at least acceptable in many areas of their performance. When you counsel troubled people, don't see them in terms of black and white. See these people as having many shades in their performance, some aspects being very acceptable and good and others not. It's been said that even a clock that won't run is right two times a day. Problem people are not always a problem. A third premise is that the supervisor's role is to help problem employees objectively perceive their own situation. When you listen to people who are entrenched in problem behavior, they have a very defensive logic and a rationale for what they are doing. Many really believe that what they are doing is correct, acceptable, okay, justified. In fact, they have faulty perception. They do not see the situation as it really is, and they are deceiving themselves. As the Scottish poet Robert Burns said, "Oh, would some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as others see us." The supervisor is going to give this person a gift, and the gift is some accurate perception of how others are seeing them and the fact that their behavior is no longer going to be tolerated, accepted, or ignored. A fourth premise that we have to accept in power counseling is a real belief that people do not want to be judged, rather they want to be understood. Supervisors are called upon to be judges within the organization. We have to make judgments about people whether we like it or not. Yet we are really trying to help this person understand. And we can only help problem employees understand by getting these people to understand themselves first. While supervisors are certainly going to make some serious judgments about this person, the primary role has to be empathetic. Don't be judgmental in what you're attempting to accomplish with them. Finally, I believe that supervisors should undertake this technique only if they believe in human potential. Supervisors who believe that people are responsible for themselves and that they are responsible for the choices they make in life might consider using this technique. Supervisors who believe people can work through their problems might consider using this technique. Supervisors who believe that people can choose to achieve a more effective adjustment might want to use this technique. But if you don't think that the person could change and become different, become better and correct existing problem behaviors, don't use this technique. If you really don't think that they have the potential to do that, then having this conversation is going to be a waste of time. On the other hand, if you're not quite ready to give up on them, if you believe they can turn it around, if you're willing to give them one last shot, if you think it's worth one last really strong, solid, tightly organized effort on your part, then this technique is for you. Frequently I get the question, Clay, how do you talk to somebody in a way that really penetrates the concrete? How do you get through when you know they really don't want to hear you? How can I, and they sound sometimes almost desperate as they say it, how can I turn this person around? Allow me to outline for you the seven-step counseling technique that is based on the very positive beliefs about human potential that I've just discussed. This technique has a definite structure and a definite sequence of steps. It won't be successful with everyone, but it will have reasonably good results with about 50 to 60% of the people you try it on. And given the fact that nothing else you've tried thus far has worked, being able to turn around 50 to 60% of the folks at this late date may make this technique worth your consideration.
Step 1. Plan your timing, setting, and opening.
The first step is to consider the timing, setting, and how you're going to open this session. You're going to want to gather all the data that you can prior to the session. You're going to want to sit down and go over your notes. Pull the lost time records if that's appropriate. Visit with personnel. Follow whatever investigatory process you feel will help you be confident you know what you're talking about. Don't get into a situation where you don't know the facts. Do your homework first. When should you have this meeting? Have the meeting with the employee as soon as possible after their next deviation. His last problem behavior may have occurred months ago. It's too late now to deal with that. So wait, be prepared. And as soon as the next thing happens, hit the employee with it. Let's use as an example through this discussion the person who is the habitual latecomer or has a high rate of absenteeism. The next time that behavior is shown, try to confront him that day or the next day. The point is to use the technique when it has the greatest chance of getting through, and that is when the occurrence is fairly recent. Another suggestion is to try to have this conversation, if possible, on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. You want to be able to see how they respond to this conversation. If you were to have this talk on a Friday, you might not see them again until Monday. On the other hand, if you talk with them on Monday, you'll be able to see how they're doing on the days immediately following. So I suggest early in the week. I also suggest having the session early in the morning or early in the shift. If you talk with them at 4:30 in the afternoon and then they go home, you won't know how they're doing till the next day. But if you talk to them first thing in the morning or at 10 o'clock in the morning, you'll be able to see how they're doing at 2, 3, 4 in the afternoon. In a sense, you're going to be doing psychosurgery, and like any good surgeon, you would want to swing by the recovery room and see how your patient is doing following surgery. You wouldn't simply go away for a week and leave the patient. Another reason for starting early in the morning is that it's sometimes difficult to predict how long the session is going to take. If you start at 4 and quitting time is 5 and you're only halfway through with the conversation at 5, you won't want to interrupt the conversation. If a patient is on the operating table and surgery is only partially completed, you don't want the doctor to say, "Well, it's golfing time, I'm leaving." Once you start the power counseling session, you must see it through to the end. The setting must be private. The employee must receive your undivided attention during a very serious conversation. If your office has windows in it, then go to an office that doesn't have windows. If you have to, paper up your windows. This session shouldn't be subject to any interruptions. You don't want other people sticking their heads into your office while you're in the middle of this. It must receive your undivided attention. If you're in the middle of an appendectomy, you don't want your physician taking phone calls while you sit there and bleed. So arrange for somebody to take your calls. Arrange for somebody to handle emergencies. In fact, nothing will be more important than completing this conversation. You may want to tip off your boss that you're going to be in this conference. If it looks like you're going to be getting close to lunch hour, then have an understanding with the person before you start that the conference may go through lunch hour so that there aren't any false expectations. How long will the session take? My experience is that you can typically count on an hour to an hour and a half. Even so, I would recommend allowing 3 hours on your schedule. Give yourself ample time should the session run over. Don't schedule any appointments immediately around this conference. You want to project a very serious image as this person comes into your office. He or she may be joking, talking about the weather, Monday night football, but my suggestion is to ignore all social conversation. You're not there to talk about the weather or any of the nice, fun things in life. You're there because there is an extremely serious problem. You need to send a message to the employee that will help him understand you are dead serious about his current performance. There are a number of things you can do to help set that serious tone. First, dress like an undertaker. Dark blue, dark black, or dark brown suit. White shirt, no flashy jewelry or ornamentation. This is not the day to wear your Hawaiian shirt to the office. This is the day to look like an authority figure. This is the day you will want to send other signals that will help the employee figure out what's going on. I suggest that you arrange your office so that you sit on one side of the desk and the employee sits on the other. You shouldn't be sitting side by side like chums on the couch. This is not a transactional analysis or human relations course. This is a tough talk between a boss and a person who has placed himself outside the accepted range of behavior. Give some special consideration to the chair that the employee will sit in. Do not use a soft, overstuffed easy chair that's very comfortable. They should not feel comfortable in this environment. Are you comfortable in planning for it? The employee needs to feel discomfort because that will help him to understand the seriousness of the offense. A number of managers have reported success using very hard chairs. Think of the most uncomfortable, gosh-awful chair you can imagine. That is the chair to use. Don't use a chair with arms. There should be as little support and as little comfort in the chair as possible. In fact, this is the hot seat. Think about the way in which a court sends a message to people who are in violation of society's standards. In a typical courtroom, the judge's bench is in fact nothing but a very big desk raised on a dais to emphasize its authority. The judge comes in wearing special attire, a dark suit of robes. His dress is symbolic of his power and the seriousness of the moment. He is dressed in black because he may be pronouncing a death sentence. The prisoner is brought before the bar and is not comfortable. The judge, through the trappings of his office, sends a very powerful message, and the message is, You had better listen to what I am now going to tell you. If you start off the conference with your problem person in some other way, wearing your T-shirt that says you're a member of the Pepsi generation, put him in a recliner and chat about the ball game, it's going to be out of sync when you start talking about performance deficiencies and discrepancies. It's simply more honest, and it's certainly more consistent to send a message to the employee that this is serious. By your dress and demeanor, you send a message the employee can pick up on and that says, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Well, every manager who uses this technique has to adapt it to his or her personality and situation. The common picture of the manager at this point is that he or she is very firm, direct, purposeful, and straight to the point. The employee may come to the office full of chatty conversation, silence the person, and say, please sit in the chair. Some managers will even motion to the chair with the pointed finger of authority. Sit in the chair. Some managers will say, we're not here to talk about the weather. We have something far more important to discuss. I want to stress again, while you can adapt this to your own style, no matter what your style, you must communicate effectively. And effectiveness in communication doesn't necessarily mean softness, gentleness, or happiness. Chris Argyris, one of America's greatest experts in attitude and behavior change, has said that when trying to change people's attitudes, they have to go through an unfreezing process. That is, there has to be a thawing of the very fixed set opinions which they now have. If the task were to melt ice, we would all know what to do: apply some heat. So turn up the heat to cause melting. When you've broken these very fixed defensive positions and rationalizations the employee has erected around his inappropriate behavior, only then will he be able to consider new behavior possibilities. Your job as a manager is to help with the unfreezing process and then provide new direction and learning opportunity. You might help as the employee comes to his own conclusions about what needs to be done. And then, Argyris says, the person's opinions will again refreeze, hopefully this time in a better constellation and arrangement than they were before. As the manager begins the conversation, he is very distant. To the employee, the manager probably appears cold, remote, threatening, and intimidating. And yet in the course of the seven steps, the manager will move from this very distant position to a very close position. There will be a transition occurring from negative to positive, but the start is negative. To continue the surgery analogy, the operation begins with some cutting and some removal of tissue. Later there will be stitching and ointments and the start of the healing process. The surgeon knows this is a problem that is not going to be cured simply by kissing it to make it better. The problem employee situation is no different. It is going to require some surgery, some excision of the employee's inappropriate behavior. So there will be some negative, distant feelings at the start of the conversation, but we are progressing through a process that will get us to those close and positive feelings eventually. One last recommendation about the opening. Concentrate on present behavior and not on past history. What a person has done in the last 6 years is not important now. What to deal with now are current infractions, the most recent tardiness. One of the reasons for picking the most recent occurrence is that it will certainly be clearest in people's minds and least subject to memory distortion. In addition to tardiness, there may be 47 other things wrong with this employee. But in this case, deal only with one, two, or three behaviors at most. The power counseling technique cannot remake this person into a perfect individual. So deal with recent events and deal with a limited list of behaviors.
Step 2. Send the confrontation message.
The second step in the process of power counseling is to present the direct confrontation message to the employee. The confrontation message contains three parts. The first part is specific information that includes the following five elements. 1. A statement of what the policy is. 2. What all employees should do in relation to that policy. 3. The facts of their own particular behavior. 4. Whose fault the deviation is. And 5. The problems that it's creating and how it makes you feel. A specific message to the latecomer could go like this.
Tom, company policy requires that all employees get to work on time. Everyone in this unit has to be here by 9 o'clock. We pay you to work these hours and to adhere to company standards. So you must be here on time each and every morning. All employees are expected to live up to this practice. Since you insist on not living up to this practice, we're faced with an issue that must be resolved. We've had repeated conversations about this, and the fact is, you were late again yesterday morning. Your lateness is your problem, and lateness is not tolerated around here. Your continuing tardiness is causing a great deal of friction. It's creating dissension among your co-workers, and it's frustrating me. I don't like it.
The second part of the confrontation is to deliver the actual confrontation message. While there's a lot of room for variation and individual interpretation in the counseling process, I would suggest that you consider using verbatim the following three-sentence message. I will no longer tolerate blank in your behavior. Effective blank date, I expect you to stop blank behavior. I also expect that by, again mention the date, you will change your behavior to, and then fill in the appropriate new behavior. In the case of our latecomer, the dialogue would sound like this.
I will no longer tolerate latecoming in your behavior. Effective immediately, I expect you to stop your latecoming and tardiness. I also expect that immediately you will change your behavior to coming to work on time each and every day.
If you analyze what is being said in those three sentences, there are several important points. First, it's good communication because in three sentences you mention twice what it is you are not going to tolerate. You mention twice what the date or timing is by which they must change. And you also mention what the expected new behavior is. Something else is contained in those sentences. Your statement of position in which you say, I will no longer tolerate it. That means you are at the end of the road, a clear and upfront message that can't be ignored. Give some consideration to how you deliver this message. I think it should be said with some drama or some impact. Some managers will say the sentences louder. Other managers will speak their piece softly or slowly. However you deliver it, do so in some form or fashion that will get through to this other person. It is very clear at this point in your relationship with them that nothing has been getting through. Find some way to dramatize or multiply the impact of your message. One manager reports that he not only delivers his message slowly, but he writes out each word as he says it. He gears his speaking to his writing speed and writes out the message about what he's not going to tolerate, and then hands it to the employee. At this point in the conversation, you've said what the policy is, that he's not adhering to it even though he should be. You've said it's his fault, and that he is causing friction and frustration. And finally, you've said, I'm not going to tolerate it. I expect you to stop it and start doing something better. Just about now, you're going to get a reaction from the problem employee. The employee is either going to rise up out of the chair and want to speak, or won't even have allowed you to get this far. In the event that you are interrupted prior to finishing the confrontation message, don't let this person speak. Interrupt his interruption saying, please allow me to continue, or say, Please allow me to finish. Most people will back off and let you do that. One of the reasons for insisting on getting your message out is that at this stage you're still playing the power and judgment role with the employee. By forcing him to comply with the modest behavior request of hearing you out, you're setting a pattern and tone of getting him to adhere to the line and direction you set. But another reason that you're not going to let him interrupt your message is because he may say something stupid. The fact is, he's only heard two parts of the message at this point. The third part is still to come. And when the employee experiences this initial attack and confrontation, he will experience an extremely defensive reaction. He'll want to respond to what you're saying, and in doing so, he's going to embarrass himself. You know where this process is heading, but he doesn't. So in order to protect his interests, if it's necessary, state it as clearly as this.
Tom, I'm not finished. Please do me the courtesy of listening to me first, and then I will listen to you.
Under no conditions, let this break down into a discussion. Do not let the employee interrupt you in step two of the confrontation process. The third step in the confrontation message is to express confidence in the employee. After you've told him what the policy and practice is, and gone over his failings and the frustration he's causing, after you've given him the direct three-sentence confrontation message, then there is one other message that you must deliver. You must express your belief that he can change and that you are trying to help. Some managers state it like this.
You know, we wouldn't be having this talk at all if I didn't believe in you. I'm really surprised that we even have to have this conversation. Given your capabilities and what I believe are your potentials, I'm amazed we're having this discussion. This problem is so far beneath you that I don't even understand how you can put up with it. I'm here to help you, but you've got to make this change on your own.
That is the first positive message the employee receives in the otherwise alarming first few moments of the counseling session. When he hears on the one hand that you are coming down hard on a piece of his behavior, but on the other hand hears positive words and beliefs and a statement that you're there trying to help and support, then that changes things radically in his eyes. You become less his enemy and more a parental figure, more a counselor, and it's a different kind of role. It's a distinct difference, and it will tend to modify his response to you subsequently. Once he has the idea that you have not closed him out, then he may stay open to the process that you're trying to work him through, and that's the goal here. Another possible reaction you should be prepared for, either at this point or a little earlier in the conversation, is for the employee to say something like this.
Well, if you feel that way, why don't you just fire me?
Beware, because this is a test question of your resolve. If you panic and say, oh, we're not here to fire you, we're just going to have this talk, then he'll know you're not serious and that he can continue to get away with it. At this point, and this is critical, go back to your own words and consider their significance. I will no longer tolerate this in your behavior. What you said in that declaration was, this is the end of the road, and that person must now comply or leave. So when they ask, if that's the way you feel about it, why don't you fire me? Respond by saying,
we're not here at this moment to discuss your termination. We're here to talk about your willingness to change your behavior.
Or you could say,
I suppose we could talk about termination if that's what you'd like to talk about, but I called you into my office this morning to see if you can do something to change your behavior so we don't have to talk about your leaving the company.
Say it however you want, but let the message be clearly understood in the mind of the employee that you have drawn your sword and that if he wants you to use the sword, you will. But also let the employee understand that while your hand rests on the sword's hilt, you have not yet decided to lay it across the back of his neck. In this way, The employee knows that the ruler is ready to take action if required, but is giving the subject one last chance to comply. I think it's very important that the employee sense no weakness or lack of resolve in your manner. He must understand very clearly that you mean exactly what you have said. You will no longer tolerate it.
Step 3 in the power counseling process is to hear out the employee's facts, fictions, and faking.
Once the three-part confrontation message is delivered, the third step is the ventilation of all the employee's excuses and reasons why they have been misbehaving. You are going to hear a stream of facts as they see them, a lot of fictions, faking, and preliminary dancing around what is really going on. Some of the things you're going to hear are projections of blame onto you. You never provided them the training. You never explained it that way before. You never did this. You never did that. And there is a possibility they may get you on one or two of those. In fact, you may not have performed your job perfectly. You may have failed to do some things that probably you should have done. But even though they may have caught you in a gotcha, do not buy into guilt. What they're trying to do is take the monkey off their back and put it on yours. If they can get you to buy into the idea that they're failing because of you, then that gets them off the hook. So simply respond,
"We're not here to talk about my failings or the failings you think I have. We're here to talk about your responsibility to comply with company policy."
Later that night, you may want to reflect long and hard on some of the things you failed to do this time that you won't fail to do next time. But don't buy into any guilt for taking action now with this employee. Your purpose at this stage is to let the employee do nearly all the talking. He should be talking 95% of the time at this point. What you're going to hear are referred to as the defense mechanisms of the human psyche. People under attack nearly always maintain their innocence, and that is a normal behavior. One of my favorite television programs a few years ago was Star Trek. When the Starship Enterprise was under attack by the alien Klingons, Captain James Kirk would order his crew to put up the defensive shields. The shields were an energy-charged defense mechanism that would spring up all around the surface of the ship. Its purpose was to deflect and fend off the laser beams and the offensive weaponry of the evil Klingons. Similarly, what you have done is played the role of Klingon attacker with the employee. You have come zooming in with your starbusters and directed a big energy blast in his direction. And now, he is going to demonstrate to you, in almost classic form, the full range of the defense mechanisms. The defense mechanisms include such things as rationalizing what they have done. Whatever they have done, they have extensive logic to back it up. You will also hear projection of blame, that it was your fault or another person's fault. Or it was hard times growing up in the ghetto, the neighbor's fault, or problems in the family. You're going to hear partial truths, you're going to hear fantasy, and you're going to hear selective reporting. During all of this, your only response should be to encourage its flow. You should be saying, "Uh-huh. Yes, I see. Then what happened? Tell me more. Go on." Inwardly, you may be thinking, "This is the biggest bunch of baloney I have ever heard in my life." But your role at this point is to listen. Just by listening, you are sending an important signal. To listen and nod and ask for more information is the behavior of a person who is on the other person's side. You may be rejecting a lot of what you're hearing. In fact, a lot of the stuff employees put out at this point is absolute nonsense or complete falsity. But in the midst of all this stuff coming down the river will be bits and pieces of information, things you may not have known, things which start to give you some insights. Recognize that you have started a catharsis. Around his problem behavior, the problem employee has put big walls of insulation, all kinds of excuses that have to be vented out of the system. In a sense, it's almost like an emotional storm or a psychological drainage. Until that emotion and anger drains out of the system, you are not going to be able to get them to the point of dealing with the problem in a constructive way. Some managers don't understand this process. They think that because the employee is giving out partial information or rationalizing, that the person is refusing to deal with the issue. In fact, he is dealing with it. But this first level of dealing with it is being expressed through the defense mechanisms. If you become sidetracked and get drawn into a discussion on any one of the points that the employee raises at this stage, you'll be making a big mistake. Say to yourself as you go into the third stage, I'm not going to respond except to encourage their talking. And if they say such and such about so and so, I am not going to get sidetracked or say, yeah, we'll prove it, or where's the evidence for that, or let's discuss that point. Don't get sidetracked. It will be absolutely counterproductive. If you can see this through the eyes of a professional psychologist and observe in an almost clinical way, you'll understand that defense mechanisms are the best way in which a struggling human being can deal with this sort of tough situation. Some managers have a difficult time accepting defensive reactions. Maybe people shouldn't be like this. Maybe they should just be able to deal rationally with all their problems and never hide the real reasons. Maybe they ought to be that way, but they're not. Effective managers are pragmatists. They're realists. They deal with people the way they are, and defensive reactions are just normal behavior. Maybe to you, defensive reactions seem immoral or unethical. If you can, avoid judging. Play the role of a detached spectator, watching an interesting behavioral phenomenon. What you're seeing at this stage is sometimes characterized by counselors as psychological vomit. That's an indelicate but apt term. When you're really sick to your stomach, sometimes the only way you're going to feel better is to get rid of what's bothering you, and that is what's happening here. Sometimes the things that prevent people from getting down to business aren't anything so involved. Sometimes there's a simple embarrassment. Sometimes you'll encounter a person who just has a very hard time with the words and can't express himself very clearly. Sometimes people don't understand themselves very well, and they have such faulty perceptions that they're really hemmed in. Again, the key behavior on your part is to listen, encourage the flow, and finally, listen for the sigh. What is the sigh? The sigh is the sound you're going to hear when a person reaches the end of stage three. Initially, the employee's conversation is going to run pretty nonstop. There'll be a lot of rapid conversation, a flow of words and stories, and then this person is going to come to a pause, an end point, and he's going to sigh. The sigh is a signal, a cue, that he's beginning to relax and that the venting process is probably getting close to an end. Other signals you can look for are slumping back in the chair, a slumping down of the shoulders, or a general relaxing of body tension. They sometimes even express it verbally.
Well, I guess that's all I have to say.
Stage three certainly represents my communications rule. Whatever I say it is, it isn't. We are so clever that we often do not express things for what they are. We put other kinds of labels and other words and other excuses behind them. We're so skilled in communicating that we know how to miscommunicate. And remember Sherman's other rule of communication, whatever I say it is, there is always more. And when you hear the sigh, when you see the employee fall silent, don't assume that's all there is. Whatever I say it is, there's always more. There are a number of ways to encourage the additional information which may not yet have been revealed. One is to simply remain silent. Your silence invites, almost forces, the employee to say something more to you. Another way to deal with it is to give him an encouraging statement.
I'm impressed with your willingness to discuss this with me. You've tried to give me an accurate picture of the situation. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Giving a positive stroke, and then the invitation to speak and say something more, is sometimes enough to prompt more talking. Keep questioning, and keep listening attentively. Often what people say at the very end of the conversation is some of the most important information you get. So if you can give the employee two or three more chances, past where you sense the normal endpoint would be, you'll sometimes get some additional useful information. Through all of this, you will have heard a lot of very interesting information. You'll be able to make some early judgments about how well the employee understands the real world. You may have discovered some internal conflicts. You may have found out about some needs. You may have gotten a different picture of this person or sensed some of the pressures he's responding to. You may learn something about expectations he has that haven't been met, which could explain why he's passively resisting by coming in late. You'll start to get a sense of what's going on with him. And my final point is that until this venting has occurred, he will be unable to go on to the next step in the power counseling process.
Step 4, define the problem and formulate options.
Help the employee better define the problem and start formulating some answers and options. As you move from distance to closeness, from pain to healing with positive behavior, Step 4 brings another opportunity in the interview where you can begin to signal to the employee that he is indeed making some progress. I would recommend that you now invite the employee to bring his chair around to the side of your desk so that the two of you can start writing some things down on paper, looking at what the elements of the problem are. You should not move your chair to be closer to him because you're correctly positioned. He's the one out of position. He's the one who strayed from the straight and narrow. By having him get up and move his chair to the side of your desk, you are symbolizing a move closer to you and to corporate standards. You're not yet totally together, but you're closer. And what brings you closer is step 4, which allows the employee to work on options for solution. A useful technique at this point in the session is to ask the employee to summarize in writing the factors he feels have contributed to the problem. The purpose of putting this on paper is that it reduces the interpersonal tension between the two parties and focuses mutual attention on the factors that are written on the piece of paper. If you're dealing with a very sophisticated employee, you might ask him to not only list the factors but to rank order them. If you're dealing with an employee that is illiterate, then you might want to serve as the secretary and write the factors down. In any event, it is important to not contribute to the list on the paper. Ask questions of the employee until the employee verbalizes the elements that contributed to the problem. If you put down your version of what's involved in the problem, it then becomes your list and not the employee's. As the employee lists factors that he thought contributed to the problem, he will put down elements that might not really be part of the problem. Don't be upset about this. In a sense, it's like he's setting up pins in a bowling alley. As you listen to the various reasons for why Tom is late, which might include his broken car, the alarm clock that didn't go off, or the fight he had with his wife the night before, realize that some of those elements were probably contributing factors and others were not. The key at this point is not to get into an argument or discussion about the things you don't agree with. Rather, when the list is complete, simply say,
Tom, I really agree with items 3, 6, and 8. It just seems to me that those stand out as the major parts of the problem.
If the employee has set up the bowling pins, the manager, in confirming certain points, is rolling the ball down the alley and hitting those pins that he agrees with. It's important to remember the objective here, and that is to reach some kind of agreement about the problem. The employee doesn't have to see the situation entirely from your viewpoint, as long as you're in agreement on the key elements. Sometimes managers ask why the elements should be written down. The purpose is to get it out of their heads and put it on paper to reduce the emotion and improve the communication dynamics. Usually these things are difficult to talk about. There are lots of factors and lots of emotion. Putting it on paper allows us to distance ourselves from the emotion, and it forces us to verbalize in a more objective way what is going on. This act also changes the verbal exchange between the manager and employee. Before, the two parties looked directly at each other and interpreted the messages personally across the desk. But putting it on paper makes the two parties look not at each other in a challenging way, but to look together at the document, side by side, in a problem-solving way. This simple technique really reduces the tension in the situation. At this stage of definition and clarification in writing, the manager should be asking a lot of questions. Appropriate questions might be,
Tom, you didn't used to be late so often. What change in your situation has caused this to become a problem now? Does not coming to work on time indicate that you don't want to be here at work? Are you still satisfied with your assignments? Do you still like your job?
What you're trying to do is help the employee gain some insight and self-understanding. The question stream also gives you a much better view of the employee's perceptions and where he has been deceiving himself in this situation. So ask as many questions as makes sense. Even write down a couple pages worth beforehand, if that will help you. There is a specific question that should definitely be asked toward the end of this stage.
Tom, what do you think your future is going to be if you continue to come in late?
In this question, you're asking Tom to predict his future, and the usual response will be along the lines of,
well, I guess I could be fired.
When that is said, and it usually will be, the employee has shown he has an appreciation of exactly where the relationship stands. The manager should then confirm that understanding.
Yes, Tom, I think I would have no other choice but to terminate you if you continue to come to work late.
On the other hand, the employee may still not quite understand and say,
I guess I don't know or I don't understand what you mean.
At that point, the manager should realize that the person's perceptual processes may be even more distorted than they seemed at first. So again, spell out that you're not going to tolerate it anymore, and that if the behavior continues, you'll have to terminate the employee. The purpose of this test question is to confirm whether the employee knows what is going to happen. And then again, ask the question of what do they think their future will be if it continues to happen. The second question that I would ask immediately after that summary test question is,
Tom, what solutions can you come up with that will prevent that from happening? What can you do to keep that prediction from coming true?
If he's with it, Tom will say,
we've been working on this list, and I guess if I get items 3, 6, and 8, that might take some of the pressures off.
By saying so, Tom is indicating that he has an understanding of the conversation that's been going on. This positive response deserves confirmation.
Yes, Tom, I think that would go a long way towards solving the problem.
Again, if the employee just can't figure out what he has to do to make this problem go away, here's another chance for you to spell it out.
Here are the items you put on your list, and if you don't do these things, if you don't get yourself to work on time, then this is what's going to happen.
Step 5, reach an agreement.
In the previous step, there was a fairly rational discussion laying out what would happen if a plan is or is not adhered to. Even though there has been a general understanding in that discussion, you should not assume there is yet an agreement. At this point, you should draw up another document, what I would term a performance contract. This contract should be written by the employee or by the manager if he or she is acting as scribe. It should spell out exactly what the employee is going to do, how they're going to do it, with whom they're going to do it, and what the standards of performance are going to be. With Tom's tardiness problem, the statement might be quite simple.
I will come to work on time each and every morning from this day forward. To help me do this, I'm going to get a new alarm clock and a reliable mode of transportation. Also, I just have to get used to the idea of getting to work on time. I'll check in with my manager every morning when I arrive so he'll know I got here on time.
The last item in that sample performance contract wording set the review schedule in place. This provides an opportunity for you as manager to review progress toward the new behavior. As a rule, I would make progress review points quite frequent. Later, when the employee seems to be getting on track, you can reduce the review frequency and let Tom come to see you on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Friday mornings instead of every day. The very act of decreasing the frequency with which review is going to take place sends very positive messages to the employee. But do that later. The performance contract should then be signed and dated by both parties. On the positive side, you're being very clear in your instructions to the employee, and you're getting the employee to put in writing what this discussion has been all about. It helps people in changing their behavior to do this. On the negative side, if the employee does not then honor the contract, you have grounds for dismissal. It was a performance contract, and they failed to perform it. What if they don't want to sign the performance contract? At that point, I would call a third party into the office, explain to him what's been discussed, and indicate that the employee doesn't want to sign the agreement. Then ask the offending employee again if he wouldn't like to sign the agreement, pledging himself to acceptable behavior. After you've given him a second chance and he still doesn't want to sign, have the third party witness on the performance contract that the employee was asked to sign this statement but refused. Should the employee be fired for not signing the document? Should that be viewed as grounds for dismissal? No. The employee wrote that he would live the standard, but simply refused to sign the paper. If he comes to work every day thereafter on time, that's the only compliance you should really care about. The purpose of getting the employee to sign is to help him make a commitment. But not signing doesn't by itself mean he won't commit. Nevertheless, to protect yourself legally, have the refusal to sign witnessed. I think the attitude and tone that should surround creation of the performance contract should not reflect legal formalities so much as the goal of clear communication. I think the attitude that the manager should display is reflected in this statement.
Tom, I want to be sure that we understand each other. I don't want there to be any misunderstanding between us later on. You've put in some real effort to come up with a workable plan. We should both recognize that this is a workable plan, so, well, let's make a commitment to it. I'd like you to sign it, and I'm going to do the same. You keep a copy, and I'll keep a copy, and there won't be any confusion later on.
In many cases, employees report that when they were in hot water like this, such an approach helped them. It assures them that as long as they live up to their commitment, they'll be okay. It isn't going to be subject to any whimsical changes later on the part of the manager, so it can be presented and used as a very positive thing.
Step 6, get a commitment.
Power counseling goes beyond the written solution statement that forms the basis of the performance contract. It asks the employee for a commitment and a promise. There are a number of commitments that are really occurring here. First is the direct request to the employee to commit to it. Tom, will you do this? By sad experience, we have learned that you cannot assume the employee will do it, even though he has written and signed a performance contract. By asking for a verbal commitment, you may get a better indication of what his behavior is actually going to be. If Tom says, "No, I won't do it," I would admire Tom's honesty and respect him for being upfront with you about that. If he indicates that he isn't going to change, then your next step would be to proceed immediately to termination. You put yourself on record at the beginning of the conversation that you were no longer going to tolerate this behavior. And now Tom has honestly reported that he won't change. The only option you have now is termination. So make the preparation for termination in advance of the meeting so that you can bring the relationship to a close as quickly and as neatly as possible. On the other hand, assuming that Tom has really sensed that you believe in him, assuming that Tom has something in him that makes him want to do better, he may respond by saying yes. If he does say yes, it doesn't mean that he actually will. But about 75% of those who say they will change make a very solid effort to do so. There will, of course, be a group of people who say they will do it, but won't. They will reveal it by the way they behave on the following morning, and these people should then also be terminated. As the employee commits to making an effort, the manager has to make commitments as well. I think the manager at this point has to, within himself, make a commitment that he is going to provide Tom with continued communication, continued coaching, continued counseling and training and other assistance that may be helpful. There's going to be a good deal of support necessary for management as the employee now struggles. You don't simply say, now that you're in the swimming pool, sink or swim. Instead, make the commitment to stand by and work with the employee. A common experience of managers who go through this process is that they learn about things that are wrong within their own department or organization. They find out about things that are acting as negative influences on the employee. And that means that the manager now has to go to work and fight City Hall if necessary. He needs to change the procedures and deal with some of these factors that are holding Tom back. Your hands may be entirely clean, but very often these cases involve a mixed bag of factors. Some elements, perhaps most, belong in the employee's area of responsibility. But other factors suggest the manager needs to clean up the operating environment where that employee functions.
Step 7, close appropriately.
You've moved a long way from the point of looking like a judge and acting like an executioner, down through an emotional venting process, on to the creation of a tentative work plan, and finally to a written performance contract with a verbal commitment. And if you're successful, you've moved a failing human being back onto the track of acceptable performance. What a great achievement! This certainly isn't going to be a perfect person when you're done with this performance counseling session. There may be a number of other things the employee needs work on, and perhaps there'll be future sessions dealing with other problems. People generally change more when they have a sense of confidence about the change. Certainly, they'll be far more inclined to make the changes you want if they leave your office filled with hope. So to end the conversation, stand up. Since you're the authority figure, the other person will also automatically stand. You now have an opportunity to bridge the last physical distance between the two of you. The employee has been sitting at the side of your desk, and you can now reach out and shake his hand. I suggest you carefully consider just how you're going to do the handshake. I think something that is a firm handshake or a handshake that is prolonged is called for. Some managers report that they use a two-handed handshake. As you grip and hold the hand, give a very brief message.
I realize this has been a tough discussion, but, well, it's been a productive discussion, too. I like the attitude and the commitment that you've shown. I said to you at the very beginning we wouldn't be having this talk at all if I didn't think you had the ability to improve your performance. I know that you'll be great, and that you'll deal with this. I want you to know I'm counting on you.
You can add anything else that might be appropriate. Generally, what's called for is a short, supportive message which clearly delineates that you are for the employee as much as you are against the negative behavior that he has shown. Some managers, when they conclude the message and have hold of the employee with both hands, pull the employee off balance toward them. This body language in which you literally tug the employee in your direction can be very effective and very moving. It sends the message that they've come a long way toward you, that you are going to actively pull the employee closer. These are the days of sexual harassment suits, so I think we have to consider the touch question carefully. Generally, the handshake is always safe, and anything else that implies a closeness that is not offensive would be appropriate. When we touch, a very human thing occurs. Having been through an emotional, difficult, and demanding experience, the employee knows he has really blown it in the eyes of his boss. For the boss to reach out that way signals in a far more powerful way than words can possibly express that the employee has not been closed off. It's not uncommon to even get a tear or two from the employee at that point as he comes to know that you're still in touch with him. What you're trying to communicate in the closing is that you're not trying to squeeze the employee out. You don't have a vendetta against him. You're not trying to railroad him or run him out of town on a rail. You're simply insisting that some behavior has to stop and a better piece of behavior has to start. I think the other piece of the closure, at least on that day, is to be sure to swing by that employee's office or workstation later. Talk to them normally and make no reference to the earlier conversation. A very powerful thing to do at that point might be to give them a piece of work and say,
"Would you please look into this and handle it?"
Giving work to an employee at this time is basically a message of trust. I still trust you to handle responsibility. I'm not going to wall up or be silent. I'm not going to pout when I go walking by. I'm not going to frown at you. This signals that bygones are bygones. Today we have work to do, and there are things I want to chat with you about. You have to send a message that says it's over now, and I'm not going to be running around here checking up on you, carrying a grudge toward you. If the employee senses normalcy from you, I think it will go a long way toward normalizing the relationship. To conclude, this technique is powerful. Don't use it if you don't accept and believe deeply the premises on which it is based. It requires some pre-planning and perhaps even some rehearsal. It works best when you take a detached, clinical viewpoint. And it's essential to keep the process on track, yet give each stage the time and work it requires. And it just may help you get through to the people who are worth saving.